Darkcast Network. Welcome to the dark side of podcasting.
Welcome to Murder
and Mimosas,
a true crime podcast brought to you by a mother and daughter duo,
bringing you murder stories with the mimosas in hand.
Just a quick disclaimer before we get started. Our show is Murder and Mimosas, a true crime podcast. This means that we do discuss crimes, including but not limited to disappearances, murder, and sexual assault. All our episodes are told with the respect of the victims and the victims' families in mind. We strive to ensure that we provide factual information, but some information is more verifiable than others. With that, grab your mimosas and let's dive in.
Hello and welcome to Murder and Mimosas. So can you tell us your name and a little bit about yourself?
Well, I'm Alexandra Kitty. I'm a former journalist and I'm also an author, but I was also a true crime researcher for Cineflex's program, A Time to Kill, also known as Homicide Hours to Kill, that airs on Investigation Discovery. And I always had an interest in true crime, and I got the honor and the privilege to write my first true crime book called Murder in the Sundown Town.
Wow. Okay. Was this some place that was close to you, or what made you pick this to write about?
Well, the story intrigued me because I worked as a true crime researcher, and there's always this a concept of fit, what fits a program or not. So when you're first starting, you don't know what the fit is. So I wanted to learn what worked for this format and what didn't work for this format. And I found out a lot of cases that I would have not known about. And this one really moved me. It moved me for two reasons. Because of it was just a tragedy. And second of all, it moved me because I knew that this would not have been a fit for this program, and it would have been absolutely essential to tell the story. So I wanted to pursue it further. How did this case that seemingly would check off all the boxes of a true crime genre for television not be able to make it through? So this is where I began going, this fits perfectly, and yet it would be excluded. And that's something that kind of got my curiosity, and I wanted to delve into that further.
Okay. Well, do you want to tell us about your book?
Yes. Basically, September 16th, 1968, there was a young African-American woman. She was 21 years old. Her name was Carol Jenkins. And normally she worked at the Philco factory, but they were in a strike, a long, prolonged strike, and she had to pay bills just like the rest of us. So she took a job selling encyclopedias. So she had to go door to door and do this. Now, this was a very resilient young lady. And on her first night, she ended up in a town called Martinsville. And she was very, very scared because there was rumors. Her brother was played basketball in high school, and he played in Martinsville, and he was the victim of racial slur. So she was very scared going there. And this was her first night on this job, and was her last night on the job because she was murdered. Right out in the open in cold blood, screwdriver to the heart. And this was totally horrific because here's a girl who did absolutely everything right and everything turned absolutely wrong. Young lady doing what we would, expect. You move on. You find a new opportunity. And when that happened, she was murdered for it. And then it took 40 years to find her killer. So this was something that, has so many elements to it. I mean, it is a murder. But it's also about sexism. It's about racism. It's about being afraid to speak the truth when you've witnessed something, and how we deal with complications of a town that had a notorious reputation of being a sundown town, which meant if you were Black, you couldn't go in into the town after sundown. You could expect something violent to happen to you, and did not. So there's a whole bunch of different very dramatic elements in play. And this was a young woman who, it was over before it began. And that to me was just, it's just something when you are a resilient person and you're somebody who can land on the feet, that's not necessarily something you want to confront. And that's exactly what this case is about, confronting the fact when somebody that's absolutely is brave, resilient, kind, moving through her fear, and have had nothing to show for it by the end of the first evening on this new job.
Wow. So did you say what year it was she was murdered? And did I miss that?
Yes, it's in 1968. So if we put that in context, there was a lot of social upheaval at the time, but you know, it could happen anytime, any place. This is what was so frightening.
So I know you said it took 40 years for her murder to be solved. Was it like from DNA or?
Unfortunately, they didn't have very much because the night she was murdered, there were torrential rains. So all the DNA, all the forensic evidence got washed. The crime scene wasn't cordoned off. So what happened were people were picking up her items. So if there was some sort of evidence, it got contaminated there. What happened was simply the killer's daughter, after witnessed this as a child, and after 40 years, finally went to the police and said, my father was Carol Jenkins' murderer. So this is... It was a cold case that we usually, you know, we think of genetic genealogy, we think of fingerprints, we think of the blood, the DNA. We rarely think of a witness coming forward decades after the fact, saying, "I can partially solve this case. My father and an unknown man, I don't know, grabbed her, and just in seconds, just took her life." And she lived with this. She told others over the years, but she was too scared of her father to actually go out and say what he had done.
Oh my gosh. So how old was this little girl when this happened?
Well, she was about 7 to 9 years old. She wasn't very old. She was literally a little girl. And she drove with her father, whom she was very afraid of. Her whole family was terrified of Kenneth Clay Richmond. And they drove and he seen Carol, who was already very afraid because she was there. And there were two young men in a car kind of getting fresh with her. And she ran to a house, Don and Norma Neal. They called the police. The police came. They determined there was nothing to be afraid of. So they left. So the Neals asked this young woman to stay, and she didn't want to be a burden. So she went back on the job, and within a short time later was actually murdered. So this was something where, you know, the police were actually, she was on their radar because of her fear. And so, as I said, this was a case of a young woman who did absolutely everything right. If you feel uncertain, you call the police. She went for help. The people who helped her wanted to, you know, took her in. The couple said they one of their biggest regrets was actually not, you know, trying to be more forceful and insisting that she stay. So they felt guilt. Not they shouldn't have felt guilty, but you always do.
Right.
You know, you see somebody who is alive, and then they slip through your fingers, and then you're always going to second guess yourself, no matter what. Unfortunately, it was just, a perfect storm, and she ended up literally getting murdered in a torrential rains and right in the middle of the street, you know, right out in public.
There were no witnesses or anything, though, or just they didn't want to come forward?
Well, there weren't any witnesses. The only witness was a young man in his apartment who heard her scream. And he ran out, and he didn't have a telephone, so he had to run to a restaurant to call the police. So there was the audio witness who didn't hear anything but her scream. So this is how little they had in terms of, I mean, they had her timeline. It was amazing how much the police could reconstruct. The witnesses seen her walking down the street, they could account on everything about the last 15 minutes of her life. Which was, you know, that was actually most important 15 minutes. And yet we know what happened seconds after, we know 15 minutes before exactly where she was. They could map out her trail quite accurately, but what they couldn't do is figure out how, and this happened within seconds. This would not have even been 15 minutes. This probably was took maybe a couple of minutes of her being grabbed, having a screwdriver thrust into her heart until it literally tore open, and they just escaped.
How do you think the world will end? Alien invasion? Nuclear disaster? Another more deadly pandemic? I'm Jackie Moranti, and I'm the host of Cause of Death, 100 Seconds to Midnight. I talk about the things that could obliterate mankind. I call it pre-apocalyptic nonfiction. The doomsday clock was set at 100 seconds to midnight from January of 2020 to January of 2023. On January 24th, 2023, the Board of Atomic Scientists moved the hands of the clock even closer to midnight. Now, it's set at 90 seconds to midnight, the closest it's ever been. From nuclear disaster to environmental threats to food and water crises, find out how mankind is destroying itself 1 second at a time. If you haven't listened to my podcast, you should.
So did they leave her body there on the street or?
Yes, she staggered about 15 feet. She still managed to stagger out in the open 15 feet, couldn't say anything, couldn't do anything, and collapsed just as it started to rain. So, I mean, it was horrible luck that she was murdered. And then to add insult to injury, the rain started coming down and washed away any potential evidence that there could have been to point guilt. So this was literally working with less than nothing. And then to compound it, there were people, bystanders who came, picked up her notebook, picked up her briefcase, picked up things that she had and gave it to the police. So their fingerprints, their DNA was all over these. So this was as messy. And Martinsville, the police at that time, they hadn't dealt with the murder in decades. So this was considered a very safe town. They couldn't solve it. And then very in short order, in a few years, there were other unsolved murders in the area unrelated to Carol's. But it's just sort of kind of came all down at once. So one tragic, murder kind of that was left unsolved kind of gave other killers ideas that they could come here and work with impunity. And unfortunately, many of them were correct.
Wow. So the daughter that turned her father in, by the time she turned him in, had he passed? Is this why she felt comfortable enough to do it?
Well, no. Actually, he was still alive. He was still alive. Okay. And what she told her sister-in-law, and then her sister-in-law told other people. So it was sort of a grapevine kind of thing that happened. And then eventually the police came to her and said, well, is this true? And she said, yes. So, I mean, she was very scared to even go forward after she felt comfortable with her former sister-in-law. But she did eventually tell police. And that's how they cracked the case open. It was just, well, there was, people going around telling other people, yes, there was a witness to this. And it was the killer's own daughter.
So was there a motive at all to killing her, or just for pleasure, or?
Well, I think it was partly for pleasure and partly because she was Black. And Black. He was a Klansman. He had a bad history. This was not the only person he was accused of murdering, except he was getting acquitted for various reasons. So he had a very violent history. There was domestic abuse in that background. So he was not known as a pleasant. Richmond was not known as a pleasant fellow. By any stretch of the imagination. So, but he wasn't from Martin's, which was quite interesting. He was driving through, seeing Carol, and saw that she wasn't with anyone because she arrived with three other people, a friend of hers who was also Black, was also her first night. The two of them worked at the same factory, got the same job. Their supervisor and another gentleman who was white. So they all split. You take North End, I'll take South End. And that's how they were working in different quarters of this town. Which they had to take at the last minute. They were going to another town called Vincent's. Unfortunately, because they were held back during the training of the first day of the job, they had to go to someplace that was closer, a little less economically prosperous, and that's how they ended up in Martinsville. So she was alone. They came as a group of four. They split up, and she got killed on, during the first few hours of this jaunt into Martinsville. And by the time her friend came back from selling, and her friend was also accosted, by the way, that night. By the time she came back, she found out that Carol, her friend that she'd known for years, was murdered. So this was something that stayed with this other young woman as well.
Hello, everyone out there in podcast land. I'm Movie Miss, one of the co-hosts of the great podcast about bad movies called Let's Talk Turkeys, where you'll find our format is a bit different than the other talking head programs you're used to. I'm a Gen Xer. My co-host is a millennial. So we're usually on the same page, but we do occasionally agree to disagree, and we always have a good laugh. Join us as we cover the good, the bad, and the ugly of cinema. You can find us on Spotify, Apple, or wherever you find quality podcasts.
Oh, but not by the same man, though.
No, right? Not that they would know. She just, okay. She was walking down the street and she was accosted. She was told to come over there and she didn't listen. She wisely left because she also felt, they felt so intimidated coming to Martinsville. They wanted to buy a tear gas gun for protection. This is how scared Carol and her friend were going here.
Tear gas gun?
That's what they were. Young women, they didn't know what to do. They didn't get one, of course.
I didn't even know that was a thing, a tear gas gun.
Neither did I. I mean, she was justified in her fear. I think that's what the scary thing was. A lot of times you're scared and people go, oh, come on. And, as I said, this was a case of, if we're talking about check marks of doing everything you're supposed to do, when your instinct tells you you're in danger, Carol did it. She did it. Everything right. I mean, everything went horribly wrong. And I think this is the crux of this case, that this is something we can all relate to. How many times in our lives we've done everything we're supposed to. We're clever. We're brave. And we plan, we create strategies, and most of us get through it. And Carol did the same thing. And for her trouble, was murdered.
That's just so sad. And she was so young.
21. I mean, she didn't even start.
Did this happen to be her first job? I mean, it might not be her first job since she's 21.
It was her second job. No, she was her second job. Right out of high school, she worked as a factory worker at Philco. The problem was that Philco was under a very intense, prolonged strike. So she was locked out. So she had to get another job. So her friend goes, well, why don't we sell encyclopedias door to door? So she said, okay. So she said, okay, I'll do this. I mean, she was known as being very quiet, very reserved. This required her being very outgoing. And the sad thing is when you read newspaper accounts of Carol's first night, she was starting to become outgoing. She was going door to door. And when reporters were interviewing the neighbors who saw her that night, they go, she was so lovely. She was so nice and out bubbly and outgoing that we really liked her. So people started to fall in love with Carol, who only met her for a few minutes. So here was something that she went out of her comfort zone to try something. And she was starting to flourish on her first day. You think first day jitters, you can understand she would be overwhelmed. Except she really took the bull by the horns and started to do a fantastic job on the first day and said, okay, if this is my situation, I'm going to make the best out of this situation. So again, check marks, pluses on Carol's corner. You can't fit all the check marks. She gets all the bonus marks. You can be proud of her. And this is the last thing someone like Carol Jenkins deserved. And I think this is what, when I wrote this, this really was something, you always tell people, be resilient, fight back, you pick yourself up, fall down 7 times, get up 8. And she did all that. And now what? So that was, to me, you know, part of the reason that her story really resonated for me. And the other is being a true crime researcher, where you're looking at cases where, yes, this fits the bill. In true crime TV, we want a victim that, you know, lights up a room where they enter and all this right. other thing. Yeah, and she's perfect. You know, she was, you know, would have been something, every, you know, something of a icon for people. I mean, they would have, yes, this is, you know, someone I can relate to. This isn't everyone. This is someone I can see myself walking in her shoes. And yet, you know, this is something that we have nary seen on true crime television. It was covered once, but there were two other cases. So this is why Carol Jenkins' story is such an awkward fit for true crime TV. That was also one of my, you know, things I wanted to explore. You know, this is some story that we need to tell over and over again. And yet we, you know, podcast do cover this. But when we're talking about true crime TV, it's a different animal completely. And this is, okay, why can't we make this? I mean, we can make it fit.
But yeah,
it's tricky.
So I know you said that he had cancer. Did he end up serving any time, or did he pass? Or
he walked out and died before the trial began.
Oh my God!
One of those things where you get up. I mean, it was what I would call a cascading catastrophe. You know, starting with the strike at Philco, culminating to the fact that the prosecutors were trying to beat the clock because he had cancer. When they arrested him, he was able to walk. He was able to move. He could, you know, he was coherent, cognizant, and it was just rapidly he declined. So they were trying to fight faster and faster to get motion in, and the defense was giving them a grief and objecting. So they were fighting against the clock. So this was a very unusual case in that you're trying to get a dying man on the stand before it's too late. And it didn't happen. So the daughter never got to testify. We never got to see if there was any other forensic evidence. We never found out. They wanted to look at his psychiatric records to see if he's ever talked about the case. If he ever mentioned who the name of the accomplice. They never managed to get any lead because he died before they could get to trial. So this is just one of those very frustrating cases where, you know, we like resolution. And a true crime TV doesn't like voids, and it doesn't like things that cannot be closed in one way. Even if it's a crime case, you still can leave it at a benchmark. And this case, we can't even really do that because it's messy. Where does one line end and where does another one begin? And this is something, you know, when you're working in true crime TV, that's something you have to grapple with, you know, minute by minute as you're working on a story. And you go, I hope that I don't have too much fuzz that might jeopardize the story. And this is one of those cases where it needs to be told, but how do you tell?
Right, because people just like things tied up in a neat little bow at the end. But yeah, it does need to be told. But thank you for sharing this. Do you want to tell everybody where they can find your book? And or is it, it's out already? Or
it's out already.
Okay.
You can get it through Genius Publishing. And I thank them for the opportunity to tell the story. It's also available on Amazon and any other online bookseller. So it's available. It's been out. And if you're interested in not just true crime and social justice, but if you're also interested in how true crime television puts pieces of the puzzle together to present a story, there's the bonus of understanding how true crime tells its tales and how things fit and don't fit. So if you're interested in that, that's also something to consider, because some of us who lived on true crime, I mean, I grew up watching true crime television for years and years and years. That was, you know, one of my passions, still is. And I had the opportunity to do this, and I said, okay, I'm going to see what it's like to be on the other side. And it's fascinating.
Well, and can you remind everybody what the name of the book is? So that they
yes, it's called Murder. It's called Murder in the Sundown Town.
Okay. Well, thank you for being on here and letting us know about this. And I can't wait for everybody to get the book and let us know how they like it and give you feedback, I hope.
Thank you so much for having me.
You're welcome. Thank you.
We always recommend more bubbly
and less OJ.
Cheers! If you'd like to see pictures from today's episode, you can find us at murder.mimosas on Instagram. You can also find us at murder.mimosas on TikTok, Twitter. And if you have a case you would like us to do, you can send that to murder.mimosas@gmail.com. And lastly, we are on Facebook at Murder and Mimosas Podcast, where you can interact with us there. We love any type of feedback you can give us. So please rate and review us on Spotify, iTunes, or wherever you listen to your podcasts.